Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Abba Yomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abba Yomi Azikiwe. Today is Thursday, March 7th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the request by the Republic of South Africa to the International Court of Justice on the situation in the Gaza Strip in Palestine. Iraqi resistance forces pledge to continue attacks until a ceasefire is reached. The current negotiations on a ceasefire is being delayed due to the intransigence of Tel Aviv. And the West African state of Senegal has set a date for the national elections. In the second and third hours, we continue our International Women's History Month programming with features on the legendary vocalist Ruby Elzy, and also the historian and editor and publisher June Milne, who worked with the late Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. You can have access to this program through the Pan-African Radio Network, and you can reach the Pan-African Radio Network at the blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And we're going to continue our Umm Kulthum Film Festival, and we're going to feature a concert from 1968. And, of course, Umm Kulthum, one of the legendary historic Egyptian artists. She, of course, made a profound impact during the 20th century. Many of her compositions was written by Ahmed Rami, the legendary Egyptian writer and poet, and also librarian and archivist. And we're going to continue this focus on the lifetimes and contributions of Umm Kulthum. And this is the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. Let's listen to the voice and the orchestra of Umm Kulthum. Thank you.
ما احسبش والهجر يا له قالوا مرار خطوة عذاب الهجر يا له قالوا مرار وعذاب واليوم
Oh, Bye.
Thank you.
والألم والزود والألم Thank you.
الحب، الحب وراه. Oh,
Welcome back. And that was the legendary Umm Kulthum with her orchestra. That was a concert recorded in 1968. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, March the 7th, 2024. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And we want to move right now into our Pan-African Newswire segment. And these are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Approximately 500,000 people in Gaza are currently on the verge of famine. The Republic of South Africa on Wednesday returned to the International Court of Justice to request further provisional measures against Israel aimed at addressing the widespread starvation among Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip. On December 29, 2023, South Africa filed genocide charges against Israel at the International Court of Justice. While the court recognized that South Africa's case holds plausible merit, it did not call for a permanent ceasefire and demanded that vague emergency measures be taken, which fall way short of the scope of the tragedy that had befallen the people of the Gaza Strip. Approximately 500,000 people are currently on the verge of famine, according to a Palestinian foreign minister. And numbers are continuing to rise as the blockade endures. In an urgent plea, Pretoria stated that it was compelled to return to the court in light of the new facts and changes in the situation in Gaza, particularly the situation of widespread starvation. It further requested the court to specify additional provisional measures in the case regarding the application of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in Gaza, citing the urgent necessity, quote, to ensure the safety and security of 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza, including over a million children. Urging the court to act swiftly, it called for these measures to be determined without a formal hearing due extremely the urgency of the situation. On February the 13th, South Africa made similar requests to the International Court of Justice to intervene and prevent a potential genocide in the southern city of Rafah. In other news, the Islamic resistance in Iraq stresses that even after a ceasefire is implemented, it will remain full ready to respond to any Israeli crime. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has stated that its two main goals lie in freeing Iraq from the American occupation and supporting Palestine in its liberation. It added that its operations against the Israeli occupation settlements will continue until a ceasefire is achieved, with the occupation showing a clear commitment to it. The resistance stressed that even after a ceasefire is implemented, it will remain fully ready to respond to any Israeli crime. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan tells the Mahadeen television network that all the Americans and Israelis want is a temporary truce and reject a permanent cessation of hostilities. Senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan affirmed that any negotiations not reaching their goal, quote, will not continue, end quote, pointing out that the Israeli occupation wants to, quote, catch its breath and worsen the humanitarian crisis, unquote, in the Gaza Strip. In an interview for Al Mahadeen, Hamdan mentioned that, quote, the obstacles have been there since the first day when the first Paris document was presented, and Hamas dealt with it realistically, unquote, adding that, quote, from the first day, it was clear that all the Americans and the Israelis wanted was a temporary truce, while they refused to cease hostilities permanently, end quote. He said that Washington is concerned about being accused of covering the crimes of the Israeli occupation, noting that both the United States and Israel are maneuvering and trying to win some time. The Palestinian official said that Hamas's position was clear from the beginning, quote, that any information about the Israeli captives comes with a price, unquote, adding that the movement demands a written agreement and cannot settle for less. Quote, if there are no clear answers, we cannot continue to go around in circles, unquote, he stressed. And finally, the situation in the West African state of Senegal is rapidly shifting. The Senegalese government has set March 24th as the new date for the country's delayed presidential election. Its spokesperson said this yesterday after a meeting of the Council of Ministers, also announcing the dissolution of the government and an appointment of a new prime minister. President Macky Sall, who is prevented for running for president again because of term limits, said in early February that he was postponing the elections for 10 months, just weeks before it was set to take place on February the 25th. The announcement plunged Senegal into chaos as opposition protests filled the streets. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we want to remind our listeners, the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, March the 7th, 2024, all you need to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Right now, we'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and that was Candy Staten with the track entitled "You, I Am the Best Thing You Ever Had," and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. Right now, we want to move into our International Women's History Month programming. This segment is going to feature an interview with Jules Milne, who was research assistant for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, the first prime minister and president of the newly independent Ghana from 1957 to 1966. Prior to 1953, he was leader of government business. He later became prime minister and then, of course, president. This is an extensive interview. Jules Milne was responsible for the editing and publishing of the books of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Let's listen to this report.
My name is Dagba Oyote, and I have the privilege of having this conversation with June Mills, a lady who's done a lot to preserve African cultural history and of some of the important works of Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah.
When and how did you meet Kwame Nkrumah?
Well, it goes back a long way. In fact, I'm celebrating the Golden Jubilee because it's 60 years ago when I met him in the year of independence. So Ghana's celebrating, so am I, here in London. Yes, I met him towards the end of 1957 at a Commonwealth conference here. He had asked to meet me because he was embarking on his second book, I Speak of Freedom, and he needed a research assistant and so on to help select suitable speeches and excerpts of broadcasts and things to go into this second book. And my husband had worked for Nelson's, which published his Nkrumah's autobiography that also came out in 1957. So he asked my husband, you know, if he could think of anyone, and he said, well, his wife was a historian and had written some history books and so on. She knew about publishing processes.
Right.
And so he phoned me up from Accra.
Oh, he phoned you?
Yes, from his office at Flagstaff House.
Mm.
We were living in Edinburgh then. And he knew, you see, that we'd spent 3 years living in what was then the Gold Coast. We both lectured at the University College of the Gold Coast. So he knew that I knew something about the country and its history and so on. So anyhow, he phoned me up and said he was coming to a Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference in a few months and would I like to consider working on this second book. And if so, we could meet, you see, when he was in London. So, of course, I immediately said, yes, I'd love to do that. So that's when I first met him.
So where in London, and how was the meeting like?
Oh, well, it was terrific, really. He was staying at the Grosvenor House Hotel. The only time he stayed there, I think after that, he always stayed at the Ghana High Commissioner's place, but he was staying there at that time. And there were a lot of people waiting to see him. We were in some sort of big room there waiting to meet him. And so, yes, it was quite electrifying, really, because I knew a lot about him, of course, being a historian and having been in Ghana and so on. And but his actual presence is really quite something. I mean, it's perfectly true, this charisma he had.
This charisma he had.
Oh, yes, tremendous impact he had. Well, and yet such a modest person. But he came in with one or two Ghanaians, you know, that had been at the meeting, I suppose, and everyone stood up. There were about 50 of us there, actually, various people from different walks of life waiting to meet him. And he just smiled, you know, and said, why don't you sit down? So he dispelled the formalities straight away. Anyhow, he went round greeting these people, and Van was with him, my husband Van, and apparently, according to what Van told me, he suddenly said, where's June? Because, you know, his books were top priority with him, and he really wanted to get on with meeting me. But anyhow, he came over, and he drew up a chair as close as you're sitting there now, really, and his first question was, tell me all about yourself, you see, and I was a bit sort of flabbergasted. I didn't know where to begin. So he said, he helped me out. He said, you studied history, you're a historian. I said, yes. And he said, which university did you go to? And I said, London. And he said, oh, thank God it wasn't Oxford or Cambridge. You must be a radical. So that really broke the ice.
He liked the fact that you went to the University of London.
Oh, yes, he thought I must be a radical, yes. He always hated these sort of Oxford accent stuff that people put on sometimes.
Yes.
He couldn't stand it. But anyhow, no, that was a bit of a joke. But he said, I've got to, you know, speak to a lot of people here. I'm having an informal lunch in a room next door. Can you stay for lunch? We could talk it over. Just myself and you and Van and my secretary, Erica Powell, at that time. Just the four of us. And so that's where we discussed it and so on. And that was the beginning, really, of, well, a long association with his publishing books and so on, until he died, in fact, in 1972.
So not only was he somebody who had great charisma that affected people when they saw him, but I also had this gift to put people at ease.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, I saw it very much at close range in the Conakry period, where it was extraordinary, really, the effect he had there. When he first went there, some of the cabinet ministers and secretaries of government, you see, came to meet him because, you know, he was co-president of Guinea.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, well, secretary wanted to step down and make him president, but he only accepted to be co-president. Anyhow, they came to greet him, and I had a desk at the end of the long veranda in his place where his office was, you know. So I used to see these people come in and hear them, what they said, and I can remember vividly one of them saying, would you like me to address you? Should it be president, doctor, or a Sadufo? And there was a slight pause, and Nkrumah smiled, and he said, my name is Kwame Nkrumah. I thought that was so typical. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. So let's go back to the actual work of publishing his books.
Yes.
First, you do the I Speak of Freedom.
Yes.
And then, subsequently, how did the relationship develop as the...
Well, before the coup, there was a marked change, you see, after the coup. But going back to before the coup, his London publishers did his books.
Who were his publishers?
Well, Thomas Nelson & Son. Yeah. That's the company my husband worked for, first of all. And then...
Perhaps to clarify that, your husband worked for
Thomas Nelson & Son, yes.
They published
his first book, first major book, which was his autobiography, and that came out at Independence, as you know. It was actually published on that day, formally, in Accra. And then, after a few years, my husband moved to Heinemann Educational Books. And so Nkrumah wanted to keep Van as his editor.
Right.
They got on very well on a personal level as well as a professional level. And so he switched to Heinemann after that. So before the coup, there were these two London publishers. But the big change came after the coup, you see, when it was a disgraceful thing, really. But at the time of the coup, the two London publishers, I should exempt my husband here, he wanted to resign, he was so furious, but they decided they wouldn't be publishing any more of his books, you see. I think it was a commercial decision.
Yes, it would have been.
Yes, because they sold a lot of textbooks in Ghana. And they, frankly, I think they made a very great mistake, really. They thought nothing more would be heard of him. Anyhow, he probably wouldn't be writing any more books, so it wasn't that important. But my husband was furious. He wasn't in a top position. He was their overseas editor. But the board, you know, decided, no, if we publish anything he might be writing, they didn't think he would, actually, then probably our books won't sell in Ghana. Our textbooks won't be sold in Ghana. So anyhow, he was dropped by them. And, of course, one of the first things he started to do in Conakry was to write A Dark Days in Ghana, about the Ghana coup. And so it was necessary to find another publisher.
So we roll forward to post-66 then.
Yes, yes.
And there is the coup. Nkrumah now lives in Conakry as co-president.
Co-president,
and he wants his work out. Did you think that his writing was very important to him?
Absolutely, yes. One of the first things he did when he arrived in Guinea was to set up an office. And Secretary closed the Ghana embassy, you know, at the time of the coup. He was so furious about the coup in Ghana, and made all their equipment there, their desks, their typewriters, all that sort of thing, available to Nkrumah, which was moved then into his residence at Villa Cilley. And so he was really able to establish a sort of office routine very quickly, within a few weeks, in fact. He'd got it going.
Mm-hmm. So there was a new focus in his writing after 66?
Yes, I would say there was. The first book, he wanted to expose the what was behind the Ghana coup.
Right.
Because he realised, well, everyone did, I think, who had any political awareness, that it wasn't an uprising of the Ghanaian people, it was an organised military coup, which in those days was commonplace. I mean, there had been 22 or something, 25 probably, before the Ghana one.
Right.
Yeah, it was getting a sort of routine. It was so easy to carry out, just a few military and police people in the capital, and the country's yours, you know, it was easy in those days. But he wanted to expose the external and also some of the internal forces behind it, because there was an opposition in Ghana who didn't like his radical policies and so on. So there was a mixture of the two, but that was the purpose of that book. And he was writing, he was at his desk within weeks of arriving in...
So as soon as he got to Conakry, he got busy.
Yeah.
He wasn't sitting down in the corner.
No, certainly not. No. And secretaries and cabinet ministers really called on him all the time. I mean, when they left the country on a mission, when they came back, they reported, you know, as though he was a head of state. Mm-hmm. You know, they had terrific regard for him in Guinea.
So the people in Guinea really, really welcomed him.
Oh, yes. I think there was this love of Ghana, really, because when they were in a tight spot, you know, when they said, the famous secretary said the famous no, you know, to De Gaulle, mm-hmm. Guinea would not be joining the French community. They were very stuck because the French really were very mean. They even took the electric light bulbs out of things. They took everything away with them. And Guinea was poor. So they were in a spot. And Nkrumah was in a position where he could arrange for what was supposed to be a loan, but it was a gift really, of 10 million, I don't know what, whether it was dollars or what, what, but anyhow, it tided them over, and I think the Guinea people never forgot it. And of course there had been the Ghana-Guinea-Mali Union before then, so they felt tied to Ghana in a way. No, they were terribly proud to have Nkrumah in their country.
So now, in terms of... your work as his publisher.
Mm.
How, tell us a little bit about the setting up of Panel publications.
Ah,
yes.
Well, I have mentioned that, you know, he was stuck for a publisher after the coup. So, when he'd done the manuscript of Dark Days in Ghana, I was out there, by the way, in June. Yes, he arrived in Conakry in March. I was out there in June.
The coup was in February 66. By March, he was in Conakry.
That's right.
And you were there...
In June, yeah.
Okay.
Because he was already... and also, you see, that his book, Challenge of the Congo, was in process of publication at the time of the coup. And he wanted to do a new preface for that. So he sent for me that in June, and so I was out there. Yes, he was going... The question of a publisher was a problem, because... there was literally no company. So he asked me to find out what it would cost to set up his own publishing company. Because he realised, I think, that if he'd been dropped by Heinemann and Nelson, there wouldn't be another UK publisher, because he was not supposed to be in power anymore. Total underestimation of his political stature, but never mind. That was very common in those days. So I found out it only cost £100 to register a company. In that case, if you know, you can print, you couldn't print a book here without having a company name to put on it. So it was his idea. He said, well, register Panaf Books, call it Panaf Books. That was a very typical choice of title, wasn't it? So the little company was registered, and it only involved myself and Nkrumah and Douglas Rogers was very useful at the time because he had a small office in Fleet Street.
Right.
He was the editor of Africa and the World, a very well-known magazine that the Ghana government during Nkrumah's time had established in London to give news of what was happening in Ghana and in the rest of Africa. It was called Africa and the World. So that's where I operated from. Shared a desk, actually, with the treasurer of Africa and the World magazine. It was an attic room, just one room, at the top of 89 Fleet Street.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's how it all started.
I see. So so after 66, your visits to Conakry now will be regular because he's writing so much.
Yes.
Okay, tell us a bit about that. That for the number of times you went there,
I found
the situation, how it was like, how you coped with everything. Just, you know.
Well, between 1966 and 1972 when he died, I went 16 times.
16?
Yes, yeah. It worked out about every 2 or 3 months, really. The rate at which he worked was phenomenal.
He wrote a lot then?
Never stopped, really. Apart from the books he wrote then, which are some of his most important, I think, he was writing pamphlets as well, you know. He was never happier than when he was at his desk and so on. Unfortunately, with the people that travelled with him to the Hanoi mission, you know, when the coup took place in his absence, were secretarial staff. It was quite a big entourage he had on that mission, and they all remained loyal and went with him to Guinea. So he had secretarial help. Yes, they all went. There was about... some joined him later, I can't tell you the number, but it was quite an impressive number. How included his own cook, you see, which he always travelled in, a few secretarial staff, photographers and so on. And I owe a lot of the photographs I've got during that period to the cameramen that went on that mission, you see, and they stayed with him. Unfortunately, their film ran out after a while and they couldn't replace the equipment, you know, in Conakry. But I've got some lovely photographs of that period, which wouldn't have happened without these loyal people that followed him there. They were offered, you know, their fare back to Accra if they didn't wish to remain with him, but they wanted to remain with him. They remained very, very loyal.
So every time you went, you had some more work that he'd completed that you were coming to publish? Or?
Yes, that's right, because in those days publishing was more complicated than it is now. You had to go through galley proofs, page proofs, and each stage had to be checked out, you see, which involved... Nkrumah was meticulous about his writing. Every word had to be gone through, you know, at each stage. And if he wasn't sure about the word, he would turn to me sometimes and say, "Is that the best word to use in that context? It's your language, not mine." So, you know, he was a stickler, really, but a great joy for an editor to work with, because, you know, he insisted on the highest standard and the accuracy of everything he said. Yes, it involved a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, which I think publishing processes now have simplified a bit, you know. You put it on disc and all this sort of thing. But in those days, there was a lot of checking to do. And I used to take supplies for him, you know, some of the medicines and things for his entourage they couldn't get in Conakry. So, but I never spent more than about, I think the maximum was 3 weeks, you know. Well, short,
you
there were short visits.
3 weeks there working with him and then...
Yes, that's right. I used to work every day in the villa. I had a desk there at the end of his veranda. He had this, it was an old French colonial style residence. It was quite a modest place where some, I suppose, French official would have stayed in colonial times.
Right.
And the secretary made that available for him. It was facing the sea, a lovely, lovely place, really. And I had the opportunity to meet people like Cabral, which was so interesting for me. Yes, Amilcar Cabral was a frequent visitor there because he was fighting this guerrilla war in Portuguese Guinea at the time. And one of the books that Nkrumah was working on in Carnegie was the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare. And I think Cabral was very interested in that and probably contributed quite a bit to the ideas in that book. Oh, Cabral was a lovely person, spoke fluent English, and they, he was in and out an awful lot, as were other guerrillas, you know, from other parts of Africa. He kept in touch with freedom fighters from other parts of Africa as well.
He was very busy in those days.
Yes.
Writing a lot, having meetings.
That's right.
He also published some of the correspondence, didn't he?
Yes.
Correspondence, yes.
Yes, that's right, in the Conakry years. That's only a small selection, really. But he had a huge mail coming in every day from supporters all over the world. That's what I tried to show in my book on the Conakry years, but I could only give a small part of it, really. So his secretaries were kept very, very busy dealing with the mail, not to mention the cables and things that came in, you see, as well.
So let's roll forward a little bit to Romania towards the end, and then we'll go back to you going back to Conakry to,
Yes.
So then one day you hear he's not very well.
Mm-hmm.
One day you go and he's okay, next time you go he's not very well.
Well, I noticed from, everything seemed to be pretty well all right till 1968. He was in terrific health then, although I was a bit uneasy because within 6 months of his arrival in Conakry, the cook that he relied on so much and did all his food for him, which he always travelled with, Amoa, I think his name was, or Amua, I'm not sure. However, he was dead within 6 months.
And
yes, he was a fit man. I think he was helped on his way, to tell you the truth. But after that, Nkrumah's food was not safe, really. The various cooks came out from Conakry and so on. I can't prove any of this, but I have a strong suspicion that Nkrumah was poisoned in the end in a slow, nasty sort of way. But Amoa was probably the first casualty, I think, because he was a fit man, and then suddenly he's vomiting, he's unwell, he's taken to hospital, and they said, oh, he's got cancer, you know, and he's dead within 6 months. It was really inexplicable, but after that, I felt very concerned, really. There was no check on his food, really. Cooks were coming up from Conakry, and of course, in those days, the American embassy was open. I heard since, I didn't know at the time, that one of the cooks that came had been working at the American embassy. But he was very fit till about 1968. Then I began to notice he's losing weight. Inexplicably, he seemed to be eating all right, but he wasn't so well as he had been.
So by 69, 70...
69, 70, he was losing weight, yes, and he was having stomach upsets. He never had trouble like that before.
But he was a very fit man through it.
Very fit, yes. I think that one of the Vietnamese or Chinese doctor, I think it was a Vietnamese doctor that attended him mostly when he was in Conakry, said he had the blood pressure of a young man, you know, when he was first there, but there was this rather slow deterioration, and quite noticeably about 1970, he was definitely a sick man, and he wanted to really to get a medical checkup in Moscow because he had great faith in Russian medicine, and he didn't want obviously to go anywhere in the West. But it was the unfortunate time because the Russians were hobnobbing with the West. It was a time of détente.
Yes.
They'd opened an embassy in Accra, and he was told that it would be inopportune, was the word they used, for him to travel to Moscow for a checkup. But they could recommend a very good clinic in Bucharest, and Ceausescu was there, an ally really of the Russians at the time. So he went there, but by that time he was a very sick man.
So by 71 he had to check into the hospital, or
in the autumn really of 1971. He went to Bucharest for a checkup, but he died there, unfortunately.
Yes, yes.
Following April, he was by that time seriously ill.
So you saw him. You saw him once or twice in
Bucharest. Yeah. Yes, I went three times there.
Three
actually.
Times.
Yes.
Mm. And each time you saw that, it was deteriorating, more or less.
Oh yes. Well, I got a terrible shock when I my first visit there. But he had warned me. Typical of him, he phoned up and said, "We must be courageous. I'm not as you remember me." And I thought, like, what exactly does he mean? He's probably gone. His hair's gone white or something. But I got a terrible shock when I saw him. He was sitting up in a chair, and his legs were terribly swollen. He said he'd been sitting there for 6 weeks because it was too painful to lie down, and he wasn't. They brought a sort of light meal, but he didn't fancy any of it, and I couldn't get any sense out of the doctor there. No, they wouldn't tell me. I didn't. Well, he had a couple of Ghanaians from his entourage that went with him to Bucharest. Wonderful people. Kwam was one. What was the other one? Oh, Yamike was there as well.
Okay.
You know, his nephew that had been with him in Conakry and always travelled with him. And they said, we can't find out. They won't tell us what's wrong with him. Perhaps that you can find out. So I asked if I could see the doctor in charge. You know, not in Nkrumah's presence, of course. And he said, are you his wife? And I said, no, I'm not his wife, but I'm his publisher. I'm very concerned about, you know, his health. And so he flannelled a bit. He didn't tell me what. He said, if we'd seen him 2 years ago, maybe we could have done something, but we can't. There's nothing we can do now. So I said, well, is it cancer, you see? Because a lot of people were saying, it was in the press here that he'd got cancer. And the doctor didn't say, no, he just said, oh, why does everyone talk about cancer? But he said, it's all over him. And I said, well, what is all over him? I couldn't get anything out of it. I don't know what they made of it, but I still maintain I think he was poisoned.
This is very... was he still writing in Bucharest?
Well, we were... When, in 1971, when he left there, Revolutionary Path, his last book, was in process, really. I mean, it was being compiled. It wasn't actually in the process of publication. But it, as you probably know, it was to be a book of major speeches with introductory passages. And, of course, there'd been people writing into him saying, it'd be nice to have a book that contains all the important... speeches and things, and to take account of what he'd written in Conakry. So he thought that was a good idea. It was his choice of title. Again, this is very typical of his modesty, because he said, first of all, I think an appropriate title would be My Revolutionary Path. Then he said, no, cut out the My, Revolutionary Path. That was very typical. Yes, it was pretty well complete by the time he went to Bucharest, but the conclusion wasn't finished, and that's what was finished, well, in the last few weeks of his life. He didn't write it, of course. He dictated it to me.
So as he was lying on his
bed? Yes, when he was on his bed, on his deathbed, as it turned out. Yes, he was telling me what he wanted in it, and then I was writing it down, you see, and then he said, read it to me. So I read it out to him, and he said, I could add more, but not now, because I think he was in awful pain. He had to have another injection. And frankly, I didn't feel I could press him any more the next day when I saw him, because, well, he was so ill. In fact, I think he'd said it all. Reading it through, I can't think what he could have wanted to add to it. It's all there.
So the next time you hear, he's gone. He's departed this life.
Yeah.
And then you set about rescuing his papers and his personal, his books from Conakry. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, well, I think realizing he was very seriously ill towards the end of 1970, he and probably realizing by then that he was not going to get back to Accra. He wanted to safeguard the future of his book, so he made a will in Conakry, leaving me in charge of his copyright and his published and unpublished papers and books. And he got it properly witnessed and everything, and I had to get an English lawyer to witness it for him, and he had it signed in Conakry legally. So that was very fortunate and a great foresight of his, really, because I might have had problems.
Big problems.
Yeah, saying, what right, you know. But he had appointed me as literary secretary, and so I had the permission to keep his books in print. Obviously, there were going to be no more books, but the important thing was to keep his books in print. That was another purpose of setting up PANAF, because the books he wrote before the coup, the publishers, the London publishers, were going to pulp their remaining stock. Yeah, it was terrible. They thought there wouldn't be any demand for them. Totally underestimated his political stature and so on. So the purpose of PANAF was to keep those titles in print and also to print the new books he was to write in Guinea. There were some very important books, of course, before the coup. You see, Africa Must Unite.
Tell us more about that.
Why? And Neocolonialism, why? Two of his major works.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Africa Must Unite, I mean, the title says it all, and that message is still valid today. But Neocolonialism was in part responsible for the coup, because it exposed, you know, the workings of international finance capital in Africa. Actually gave charts showing the network of these big foreign companies that were exploiting Africa's resources. And that was probably the final straw in deciding this dangerous man has got to be removed, you know. We cannot have Africa united or in control of its own resources. And so that was a factor, because it had such an impact in America. The American government immediately stopped aid to Ghana when that book was published, yes, and lodged a very strong diplomatic complaint, you know, through their embassy in Accra, complaining about the book. I don't know any other book, really, that has created such a political stir as that one.
Challenge of the Congo?
Well, that wasn't perceived as such a great threat. You see, it was concentrated on the Congo. It did expose Union Minière, you know, and how the Belgian company had exploited the Congo's wealth. But this book was really dynamite. And but it was the final straw in a big build-up that had been going on for some time against his policies, and especially his Pan-Africanism, which was perceived as a great threat. I think it is still perceived as a threat, because once Africa is united, it'll be in control of its own resources. And that's the last thing, really, that these economic interests want.
What kind of audience do you think Kwame Nkrumah had in mind when he was writing? What kind of audience do you think he had in mind?
Well, it wasn't just for the Ghanaian public. It was a global thing, because he regarded what people called his political philosophy Nkrumahism, but he regarded it as a global movement, and it still is very much so today, I think. Because the problems of Ghana and Africa as a whole are replicated in the Far East. It's still ongoing in various parts of Africa and in South America. These are the great areas, you know. No, he wasn't right. Basically, he had in mind, obviously, the Pan-African readership, but it was a global thing, which, being a statesman that he was, his vision incorporated in a sort of global context. And if you look at his friends and his contacts, you've got Castro, you've got Nehru, Sukarno, yes, that's right, I mentioned him. Castro was a big factor. So he was a global figure while he was in power in Ghana, and that didn't go just because he'd gone to Conakry.
A little bit about the actual act of getting it letters and papers from Conakry and getting them onward to
Oh, that was quite a problem, yes. After Secretary managed to stay in power a few years after Nkrumah died, but he was eventually overthrown in a coup, again under very suspicious circumstances. And I was worried at the time because I thought, what's going to happen with a military regime there and so on? Do the correspondence files and all this historical material, which I knew must be still in Villa Cilli, but I thought that at least, you know, the material there would be put either in a safe place or it would be guarded in that villa. I underestimated really what could happen there. But after Secretary had gone, there was a military regime, of course, and I couldn't get a visa or anything to go, but I wanted to go as his literary executress to see what had survived and make a list of everything that was there and so on, not necessarily to bring it back. But in the end, I had to go without a visa and just risked it. It was 1987. And it was just as well I went, actually. But I took a bit of a risk, to say the least. because Camara Sana, the Guinea protocol officer that had been in charge at Villa Cilli, you know, interpreting for Nkrumah and all this sort of thing, he was, of course, out of power. He was nobody. He was a very big man under Secretary's government. He was, in fact, Secretary's right-hand man that he drafted to serve Nkrumah. He was just a nobody, but he wrote me an air letter in 1980, the end of 86 or beginning of 87, out of the blue, because I was pondering how on earth I'm going to get out there. No Guinea embassy in London, and I couldn't get any contact from their Paris embassy. They didn't want to know, you see, any connection with Nkrumah or Secretary, and they wanted to know what my purpose of going there was. So it was there was a problem. Anyhow, fortunately, I had this letter from Camara Sana, and he put a box number, so I immediately wrote back and said I would like to come and just, you know, check to see what was still surviving and so on. He said he would, it was difficult, but he would meet me. So I couldn't get a visa. I decided to go without one.
Very brave.
Well, it was a bit risky. When I got to Paris, of course, you had to change planes in Paris. They said, where's your visa for Guinea? I said, I haven't got one, but I'm afraid I told a white lie. I said, I'm being met by government officials. It's all right. So they passed me anyhow. They were glad to have somebody to travel on Air Afrique, I think. Towards the end, it stopped several times. Myself and two Lebanese businessmen were the only people that wanted to go on to Conakry. They all got off at Nouakchott or somewhere, you know, in between. No, nobody, and especially, she's obviously not a tourist. You don't go to Conakry for tourism. But I had a big problem when I arrived, actually. I don't know whether you want to hear all this.
Not all.
Well, just I'll try and make it brief. But, yes, it was a problem because, you know, queuing up to go through the formalities, the checks. I said, immediately looked at my passport, where's your visa, you see, and I said, I haven't been able to get one. They said, well, wait over there, you see, and I thought, oh, Lord. It was the end of the day, and I thought, I'm just going to be put on the return flight back, you know, without a visa. But fortunately, Camara did turn up, but he'd had trouble getting some old taxi or something to get there. He was really looking so down and out, poor Camara. But anyhow, he turned up and he came and spoke to them in French. And they said, he said he would take charge of me and not to worry and all. But of course they didn't recognize him and he was a man of no importance then. But they said they would have to keep my passport and I would have to get a visa from the Home Office or whatever in Conakry before they would return my passport. So it was a bit worrying, actually. I had to leave the airport without my passport. But Camara managed to get a photographer that got a bit of film left, and we, long story, but he managed to get it. So, but then getting to see the papers, see what was left in the Villa Cilli, was a problem because the military had taken over. He said, Camera told me that it was filled with soldiers, but he thought the files and everything had been packed into tea boxes and sealed. And I mustn't go near. He said, you must lie low here in Conakry. Lie low. I will see if I can, you know, see them and bring them to you. Fortunately, he said, the commander there at the garrison in Villa Silly came from his village, and he might be able to arrange something. Right. So, long story short, in 2 or 3 days, he managed to bring the stuff to his little bungalow. I was staying in a very grotty little hotel, no air conditioning, and it was terrible in Conakry. But anyhow, I went there to his place during the day, and he brought the stuff there, but it was just thrown in the old house. The soldiers had broken into the boxes looking for valuables, I suppose, and they didn't think papers were valuable, of course. No, soldiers for you, but I'm glad they didn't think so. But they hadn't bothered sealing them or anything, so they'd been exposed to insects and all this sort of thing. I was just in time, really. But I realised I'd have to bring them back with me. So I had to give Camera some money to go and buy a suitcase in the market. And I brought all the correspondence files back. I couldn't bring all his little library back. He had a small library of books there that he'd collected during the years, most ones I'd sent or taken with me. And he always annotated his books, and so I had to sort through the ones that he had actually written in, because I thought these would be valuable for students to see what comments or what he had marked as important. I was able to bring those back, and his correspondence files, but I had to leave some that hadn't got any marking.
The Camera would go back and secure them, you think?
Yes, he brought everything that had been packed in these boxes. He had packed them, actually, when Nkrumah died, and he returned. You know, Nkrumah had a state funeral in Conakry. So Camera came back with the body
to Accra.
To Conakry.
To Conakry.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. Yes, they wanted me to go, but I said, no, I'm go to London from Bucharest and carry on with the books. If I'd been his wife or something, it'd been different. But I said, no, he would wish me to ensure the safety of his books. It wasn't appropriate for me to go. I thought his wife from
Fatia would go.
Fatia would go, yes. She didn't. Yes, she did go, yeah.
Why did you choose Howard University as the place?
Well, some of the stuff I thought really should be placed into safe hands, especially the correspondence files that had damage from mice had actually got into one of the boxes, and they'd eaten the edges of the files and so on. It needed expert paper care, you see. And I thought, well, there's nowhere in Africa that I could think of that had got the facilities and proper air conditioning and this, that and the other, paper experts. And I thought the material should be put on disk and all this sort of thing, available for scholars. So the first thought was Howard University, which is the biggest black university in the world and got all the expertise in the world. And they had a research centre, the Morland Spingarn Research Centre. So I wrote to them first, and No, I didn't write them first. That's right. I went out to see them. That's right, yes, to see if I thought it was suitable. Yes, the sequence, forgive me, but it's a long time ago now. I think I had made the contact, that's right.
Yes.
And then I decided to go and see for myself. And I was really very pleased with what I saw. And first thing you notice going into Morland Spingarn, great pictures of Nkrumah's, they had all his books in their library. And the students, of course, were very enthusiastic supporters of Nkrumah. In fact, Howard University tried to get him to be, take a position at Howard University during the Conakry years, some sort of honorary something or other. But, they recognized his importance and so on. So it was a suitable place to deposit, some of the material that couldn't wait. So they've got some very important material there.
What do you think was Nkrumah's greatest gift to Africa? What what, if you could summarize?
Oh, I think his Pan-African vision of a united continent. That was behind all his thinking and all his writing. Always talking about it. Because he thought that the position of the ordinary people in Africa could not improve until the continent was united and was in control of its own house, in other words. First thing always on his mind was the political kingdom, you see. You know, you remember he emphasized that all the time. Until you have political control, you're in control of your own house, you can forget about your welfare, because other people will be coming in to take that, especially a rich continent like Africa. It used to drive him mad when people talked about poverty in Africa. I mean, he knew obviously the African people were poor, but he said people are mixing up. The continent is not poor. It's the richest continent in the world with the poorest people. So something has to be wrong. You've got to ask the question, why is this the case? So all his writings really have this in view, really, the Pan-African context. His book, Challenge of the Congo, the subtitle is, I can't remember the exact detail, but it's about the similar troubles in independent states, you know, that are not in control of their resources. And the challenge of the Congo was to highlight the example of what had happened there. Of course, Union Minier had been exploiting, you know, its resources were not benefiting the people of the Congo. But there's always this Pan-African vision. That's the greatest, I think.
Well, how does it feel to have worked so closely to... How does it feel to have worked so closely with...
Well, it's a tremendous honor. I mean, for a historian to meet with someone who's making history and then to be play a very minor part in it, you know, after the coup, that was perhaps the best experience really of the whole time, because he had more time to reflect there. We had long conversations, you know, in Villa Cilli that wouldn't have been possible while he was in government. He was too busy, you know. It was mostly checking his books and the texts of his books, but we had time to talk about what was going on in the world and all this sort of thing. I got to know him much better after 66. But it was a tragedy for the whole of Africa, really, that I think Kaunda is a bit of a gloomy person, but he said Africa will never recover from it. I think they will, because his vision has lived on. But it has did set back the clock in Africa, there's no doubt about it. Before the coup, in Flagstaff House, in the sort of waiting room, adjoining his office there, waiting to go in. And sometimes I'd been there with ambassadors and important people sitting there, and he would send for me first, you see, because his books were so important, he wanted to get that done. And really, I got some nasty looks from some of these people that thought, you know, who's this blooming woman going in ahead of us? I'm a big cheese here, you know. But total disregard for that sort of thing.
No stand on ceremony. Was
no standing on ceremony at all, no.
And the ability to make everybody in the party or what in the circle feel that they were important and their role in history was as important as his.
Well, Erica told me once that she had this little office, you see, adjoining his in Flagstaff House, and she was very amused. At cabinet meeting, she said all she could hear was roars of laughter, you know, and it was always a jolly occasion. Yeah, I've never seen him. He couldn't stand people that put on airs at all. But he carried out, in practice, his door was open to anyone. You know, market women would come. Erica used to get a bit concerned because for his security after a while, because, you know, there was a bit of discontent in the country from certain quarters, and there were 2 bomb incidents,
indeed,
you remember.
Indeed, yes.
His life was in danger, and she thought it was dangerous for these people coming out. But he didn't like shutting the door on anyone. But after a while, his security people began to take control and said, we can't go on like this, any Tom, Dick and Harry coming. But it wasn't his wish to be shielded from anyone.
You wanted to speak about the last time you saw him in Ghana.
Oh, yes.
Because, before he left for Hanoi.
That's a very strong memory I have, yes. There was a lot of talk of coups at that time, because in January, the last time I saw him was in February, but in January there'd been a coup in Nigeria, and Balewa's government had been overthrown. So it was, the talk was on people's lips. It was a dangerous sort of time. And I got the feeling for the first time, usually when I arrived on my trips there, and I can't remember the exact number of times I went before the coup, but it was very often. I'd always felt sort of elated getting out of the aircraft. And there was a sort of happy atmosphere, you know, children, school children going to school with their satchels. It seemed to be a happy time, building going on, Tema Highway being built. But that last visit, there was a bit of unease, and even with the Volta opening, there was a big dinner they had. I think it was the night before. Anyhow, Kaiser was there, one of the people that had helped with financing the Volta Dam. Mm-hmm. And the lights suddenly all went out. And I thought, this is very odd. So we were in total darkness. We were all sitting there, you know, this big occasion. Masses of tables, hundreds of people there, including Kaiser, but they came on again. I thought, I hope it's not an omen, but people were a bit jumpy, and especially those close to him, even his wife, didn't want him to leave the country, because there were talk of coups, and there were a bit of discontent with shortages of various food. It's part of the economic sanctions that were being applied insidiously with Ghana. You remember the price of gold and cocoa, the main export, suddenly dropped on the world market. There were these sort of pressures that Mugabe's facing now, insidious, but not claimed by anyone, but they had their effect. So there was a slightly uneasy feeling. But yes, you asked me, the last time I actually saw him was in the castle. He didn't drop and work there, but occasionally he would use his office there, and it was in the castle. And we were going through the page proofs of Challenge of the Congo, and suddenly there was a knock at the door, and it was either the foreign minister or somebody from the foreign ministry came in, said there'd been an urgent cable from the Ghana embassy in Washington that he had to show Nkrumah, and it was, the message was that the Americans had agreed to stop the bombing of Hanoi for 3 days to allow his plane to land safely, because Ho Chi Minh had sent a message previously saying, I cannot guarantee the safety of your plane coming on this peace mission because the Americans are still bombing Hanoi. So the Americans had sent this, desperate for him to go, because they wanted him out of the country, clearly. It wasn't foreseen at the time, but of course Nkrumah was determined to go. He reckoned he had a viable peace plan, and I think he probably did have, but the main thing was the Americans were terrified that he wouldn't go, in which case their plans for the coup in his absence would not be successful if he was still on Ghanaian soil. However, I was there when that message arrived, and Nkrumah, I don't know, I don't think he suspected obviously that it would happen. But it was, people were jumpy a bit at that time. Anyhow, he was determined to go, and it was only a few days really before he said, why don't you stay on here? We've been working very hard, you know, on the page proof. Stay and have a bit of a holiday, and when I come back we can finish it off. Fortunately, I said, I think I better get back with it now, because the London publishers were waiting to, you know, do the final processing. And also, I wasn't frankly interested in a holiday without him being there. The whole joy of being there was working with him. And so there seemed nothing, no point in staying on. Fortunately, I did leave, and with the page proofs, corrected page proofs. So that was very important, actually. But no, he was determined to go. Apparently, there were two plans that this is what was discovered, I think, afterwards. There were two plans. There was a British plan. The British were in on it. It wasn't just a CIA thing, and I think West Germany intelligence was also in on the scheme. The British one, Harold Wilson's plan, was to get him assassinated as he walked the aircraft before he left. But the American plan was, no, do it when he's so far away that he can't, you know, he can't return. And actually it didn't happen until his plane had reached Rangoon. It was too late to return in 24 hours. But so the American plan was adopted. And, well, it did work out, as we know, but the Harold Wilson plan, in a way, it's credit to Harold Wilson, if you can see it that way, that he didn't underestimate Nkrumah. He knew that he would still be a threat as long as he was alive, whereas the American underestimated him. They thought, nah, he'll be, once he's out of power, that's the end of him. We'll hear no more about him. Total underestimation. So I was there actually seeing this ploy, you see, in the final thing. I think Nkrumah couldn't have gone if the bombing had continued, because Ho Chi Minh wasn't prepared to receive him on those conditions.
No, it could not
have. It would be, yeah, he could well have been shot down, because there was very heavy bombing going on at the time.
Yes, there's a lot of bombing.
So again, that reinforces the theory that, well, we all know now. I mean, it's commonly claimed. In fact, the CIA have claimed it as a victory. One of their chief operatives has written a book, In Search of Enemies, in which he said that he got a promotion, the CIA man in the craft, for the successful coup. Yeah.
Interview with June Milne, who was the research assistant, editor, and publisher of the books and pamphlets of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, March 7th, 2024, and Ghana independence was celebrated just yesterday, 1957. Of course, this would be the 67th anniversary of Ghana independence under the leadership of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. We'll take a break and we'll be back with our concluding segments.
Don't you abuse it. I gave you tender love and care. Oh, baby, now don't you misuse it. Girl, and if you got somebody, if you got somebody else on your mind, I want you to please, 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 baby, let me down easy. I sweated and toiled for you, baby. I know, I know you know it. But if you got any appreciation for me, you got a sad, sad way of showing it. Oh yeah. If you got somebody, if you got somebody, if you got someone else on your mind, I want you to please, 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 oh Lord, let me down easy. You ought to give credit, baby, yeah, oh baby, where credit is due right now.
With the track entitled Let Me Down Easy. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, March 7th, 2024, and March is International Women's History Month. We're going to move to another historic figure, African-American woman Lucy Parsons, who lived and organized during the late 19th and early decades of the 20th century. Let's listen to this report on Lucy Parsons.
The day will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you are throttling today. As the final words of condemned anarchist August Baz sparked a labor revolution, a dynamic leader emerged. In the late 19th century, Lucy Parsons, the embodiment of a disenfranchised America, challenged the racist, sexist, and capitalist society surrounding her. Her radical form of activism shaped class consciousness in Chicago and the world by exploring and enlightening America's working class to the ways of revolutionary politics. Lucy Parsons led common workers as they encountered labor struggle, explored their rights, and exchanged ideas for a better future. Few events in history have challenged the basic rights to assembly, free speech, press, and the right to a fair trial as directly as the 1886 Haymarket Affair. The 1886 Haymarket Affair was the result of years of struggling for proper working conditions. during the period leading up to the riot, workers encountered fierce opposition from business leaders and government authorities who limited their constitutional right to assemble and protest poor working conditions. So how did a band of rebels, including Lucy Parsons, affect such change in history?
Come all you workers and hear what I say. They're trying to plunder the 8-hour day, won by our forebears in a bloody campaign. So rise up and be in the struggle again.
Most workers were working 10 to 12 hours per day, 6 to 7 days per week. Factories were filled with rats, disease, and dangerous machines. Child labor was common. The government had passed an 8-hour workday law, which it failed to enforce. Tension in America was building, with individual workers having no power. The only hope these workers had was to team up and collectively fight for their rights. A critical leader emerged named Lucy Parsons. Little is known about Lucy Parsons. She was a woman of color born in Texas and thought to be of Mexican, Native American, and African American descent. Her exact birth date is unknown. After leaving Texas, where her interracial marriage to Albert Parsons was not recognized, the Parsons landed in Illinois. She had two children. Her most recognized name was Lucy Gonzalez. Most believe she had been a slave and suggest this is why she fought so strongly for better labor rights. So how did Lucy, her husband, and her accomplices become such instrumental figures in history? Albert Parsons became involved in the railroad strike of 1877 by urging peaceful protest. In 1883, the Parsons helped begin the International Working People's Association, but it was their central role in the Haymarket Fair that solidified their place in history. The Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions declared May 1, 1886 to be the start of a nationwide labor movement demanding the 8-hour day. Albert and Lucy Parsons helped organize the largest rally in Chicago by marching with 80,000 workers up Michigan Avenue. On May 2nd, Albert left to set up rallies in Ohio while Lucy organized another peaceful rally of 35,000 people. On May 3rd, policemen shot at picketing workers at the McCormick Reaper factory plant, killing at least one man. In response, a protest meeting was planned for the evening of May 4th. 20,000 people were expected, but most planned speakers did not show, and only 2,500 people attended. Eventually, two last-minute substitute speakers stepped in. They were Albert Parsons, just returning from Ohio, and Samuel Fielden, arriving from a women's sewing meeting organized by Lucy Parsons. They climbed onto a wagon and addressed the small, peaceful crowd. Near the end of Samuel Fielden's speech, with only about 200 people remaining, 176 policemen called for the meeting to disperse. At that moment, a homemade bomb flew into the ranks of the police, and the police shot wildly on the crowd, killing some of their own men. 7 or 8 policemen died, and at least 4 meeting attendees. The next day, martial law was declared in Chicago and across the country. Police arrested a number of people. Initially, 31 people were indicted for the murder of policeman Matthias Deegan. Most were not even at the rally. 8 prominent members of the labor movement were chosen to stand trial. The 8 anarchists were Albert Parsons, Samuel Fielden, August Spies, Louis Ling, Adolf Fischer, George Engel, Michael Schwab, and Oscar Niebe. An outraged Lucy traveled throughout the country on a campaign for the release of her husband. She made impassioned speeches about the injustices of the trial. Despite her efforts, the jury found them guilty and sentenced Niebe to 15 years in prison, while the rest of the men were sentenced to death by hanging. Fielden, Schwab, and Niebe wrote letters to the governor for clemency, and their sentences were reduced to life in prison. Albert Parsons instead wrote a letter to America for justice, and only accepting liberty or death. Engel, Fischer, Spies, and Parsons were hanged on November 11, 1887. The night before, Ling committed suicide in his cell by detonating a bomb in his mouth. Hundreds of thousands attended the funerals for the anarchists. 5 years later, Governor Altgeld pardoned the remaining anarchists from further punishment. Lucy was determined to continue the fight. In 1905, she became a founding member of the Industrial Workers of the World and began editing The Liberator, where she used the paper to fight for women's rights. She supported a woman's right to divorce and remarry, to have access to birth control, and for equal pay. She was often arrested for her beliefs. She would later spearhead a movement calling attention to the unemployed, hungry, and homeless. The 1915 Poor People's March of 15,000 unemployed women led by Lucy resulted in the federal government instituting unemployment and hunger assistance programs. In 1927, Lucy was elected to be on the International Labor Defense, where she actively aided in high-profile trials fighting for the civil rights of the victims of racism. She organized against the executions of Sacco and Vanzetti, immigrant labor activists wrongfully accused of double murder. After their execution, judicial reforms were put into place to review entire records in death penalty cases. She also defended Angelo Herndon, who faced 20 years in jail for trying to organize black and white workers in Georgia. After his release, the Supreme Court determined the insurrection law violated union organizers' right to free speech. The ILD and Lucy were also involved in the infamous Scottsboro 9 trial. The case against 9 black boys falsely accused of raping 2 white women on a train highlighted the injustice of an all-white jury as not a jury of your peers. All defendants were exonerated. Lucy Parsons was once described as more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. Upon her death in a house fire in 1942, the FBI and the Red Squad quickly removed all evidence of her writings. Despite Lucy's prolific writing and long life of activism, her name is mysteriously absent from the history books. All that remains is a small gravestone in the shadows of the Haymarket Martyrs Monument. Regardless, there is no denying she affected change and continues to impact our world today. After the Haymarket affair, workers started to believe that they could achieve better working conditions and better lives if they worked collectively. After years of protest, this spark of an event ignited the labor movement. The labor movement burst into flames and rapidly spread across the nation and the world. Employers encountered an emerging strength in their workers demanding better working conditions. But for Lucy Parsons, a woman of color, the labor movement arguably would not have seen the successes it did. Safer working conditions, an enforced 8-hour day with a minimum wage and time and a half were established. Child labor laws are strictly enforced for those under 16. Unions are protected under labor laws established since the Haymarket affair. Constitutional freedom of assembly and speech were strengthened. Unions gained strength in numbers and power. Many of those unions remain strong and continue to fight for the rights and protection of their workers. Lucy Parsons and her activists explored the landscape of labor struggles, encountered adversity and oppression, and exchanged outdated ideas for real change. The legacy of the Haymarket Affair is, out of tragedy, a stronger, healthier workforce and nation emerged. What would your world be like without Lucy Parsons and the Haymarket Affair?
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
Welcome back. And that was a segment on Lucy Parsons, the anarchist and communist political leader and organizer and theorist of the late 19th and early decades of the 20th century. We'll take a break and we'll be back with our concluding segment for the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast.
Just to see me strut this stuff of mine.
Lucille Bogan, also known as Bessie Jackson, with the track entitled Strutting My Stuff. And here's another segment featuring the lifetimes and contributions of Lucy Parsons.
Lucy Gonzalez, born 1853 on a Texas plantation, grows up and finds love with Albert Parsons, moves to Chicago, hoping to escape the intolerance of their interracial marriage. Chicago at this time, growing immigrant population, exploited workers, revolution is in the wind. 1877, the National Railroad strike erupts. Government militias take the lives of 100 striking workers. 1879, Lucy is with child, working as a dressmaker, financially supporting her husband, organizing housewives, writing for the radical press. Fighting spirit, working hand, Lucy labors for the revolution. The Chicago Tribune says, "When a tramp asks you for bread, put arsenic on it and he will not trouble you anymore." Lucy responds, "Let every dirty, lousy tramp arm himself with a revolver or knife and lay in wait on the steps of the palaces of the rich and stab or shoot their owners as they come out. Let us devastate the avenues where the wealthy live, as Sheridan devastated the beautiful valley of the Shenandoah." On May 1st, 1886, workers across the country strike, demanding an 8-hour workday. Lucy and Albert lead a march of thousands. Days later, police kill striking workers in Chicago. Anarchists, communists, laborers come together in Haymarket Square. The air is still. Police come in droves, demanding the peaceful mass of workers disperse. A bomb flung from the crowd towards the police. Chaos erupts. The police shoot at workers and at themselves. The air is smoke, fury, and death. Afterwards, the state terrorizes anarchists and communists. Workers' homes are raided. Lucy is not spared. Albert is arrested along with 7 others who have nothing to do with the bomb. The state convicts these 8 men. Anarchy is on trial. Lucy tours the country, organizing a defense campaign for the Haymarket 8. Lucy says, Had I been there, had I seen those murderous police approach, I would have flung the bomb myself. I do not stand here to gloat over the murder of those policemen, but when a ball from the revolver of a policeman kills, it is as much murder as when death results from a bomb. The state executes Albert. Lucy grieves. Lucy gets back to work. She continues writing. The police steal and destroy her pamphlets. But Lucy persists, resists, exists. She remains irrepressible. She is alive in the streets of Chicago, joining picket lines with striking workers, giving speeches, handing out incendiary leaflets. The police continue to harass her. She is unyielding. Lucy helps found the Industrial Workers of the World in 1905. At the inaugural convention, she is the only woman to give a speech, arguing that sex workers be allowed to organize with the IWW. She travels the country, speaking to workers. Eyesight failing, her heart continues the work. Lucy heads south, fighting to defend the Scottsboro Nine, the unjustly accused Angelo Herndon. In 1941, Lucy gives her last speech at the same factory that catalyzed the Haymarket Affair. 1942, Lucy dies in a house fire. 89 years of relentless struggle. 89 years of believing in the power of the working class. 89 years of believing in herself. The Chicago Police Department called Lucy more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. Lucy said of the police, "We cannot help but believe that were every law, every court, and every police officer or soldier abolished tomorrow with one sweep, we would be better off than now." May we all hope to be more dangerous than 1,000 rioters.
Welcome back, and that was a segment on Revolutionary Lucy Parsons. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And we'll close out, but if you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Shirley Scott from the 1967 release, Now is the Time. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you. Thank you.